Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the Fast Forward Radio Archives on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this program, which originally aired December 16th, 2007. This is a back-to-back landmark show. We just 2 weeks ago had the first appearance of PJ Manny on Fast Forward Radio, and tonight we're presenting the first appearance of PJ Manny as a guest host on Fast Forward Radio. This was a co-hosting effort of Stephen and PJ with the special guest Pearl Chen, who was at that time the president of the Foresight Institute. Great discussion ensues amongst the three of them, and if you guessed that nanotechnology is on the docket for this discussion, you guessed absolutely correctly. Coming up later this week on Wednesday, we've got our live show, and our topic is cars for the blind and other improbable scenarios. We're going to talk about possible developments, possible situations, possible future scenarios that don't sound terribly likely, but that might just pan out after all, and what they have to say about what our future might look like. On Saturday evening, we have completed, of course, the World Transformed Archives, so we're going to start a short series called WT 1.5. That's the World Transformed 1.5. This is a bridge series, bridging us between the original World Transformed and the World Transformed 2, which will be coming up a little bit later this year. In this opening segment of WT 1.5, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what the possible topics might be for the World Transformed 2 and how the show might be structured. So be sure and tune in for that. I hope you're able to join us for all of our upcoming programs, and I hope you'll enjoy our interview with Pearl Chen, which begins right now. And until next time, live to see it.
Welcome to the Fast Forward Radio Show. Fast Forward Radio is the official podcast of the Speculist weblog. Our blog and this podcast are all about the future. We cover futurism, accelerating change, development, and, pretty much that whole gamut. And nanotech really is a part of this, and so we're glad to have with us this week Dr. Pearl Chen, who's already on the line with us. And welcome, Dr. Chen.
Hello, how are you, Stephen?
Doing great. And also I've got with me, as co-host this week, I've got PJ Manny. PJ, you didn't realize you were going to be auditioning for co-host when you were our guest a couple of weeks ago, did you?
I had no idea. Probably best you didn't tell me.
Well, I'm kind of glad we didn't, because it's good to have you on now, and we didn't scare you away with that.
Likewise, thanks.
Yeah. Anyway, and Dr. Pearl Chen is the president of the Foresight Nanotech Institute, and I got to tell you, my regular co-host Phil Bauermaster said he could not be more bummed out that he is missing this evening. He is on the road this week, and he is really hates that he missed this particular program, Dr. Chen. But we're glad you're here, glad to have PJ here, and glad to get to visit with you here in just a second. I wanted to mention in passing real quick that a friend of our weblog goes by the name of Triticale. That was his nom de plume, I guess. His real name was Tom Arnold. He passed away of leukemia this week. I've read his blog, and I've read his comments all over the blogosphere, and of course at our own blog, The Speculist. He was always such a neat gentleman, and he had a great sense of humor, and gifted thinker, writer, and I know he'll be missed by Phil and I both, but really everyone that every blog he contributed to and his own as well, he was just a real neat guy, and hated to hear that he had passed away. So anyway, that said, I wanted to go ahead and begin our interview, Pearl, and let me just introduce you if that's okay.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Dr. Pearl Chen is one of these people that I could spend too much of the interview time introducing her. So I'm going to try to keep it short. She has extensive experience in strategy and marketing consulting. She's done management consulting. She's done operations, sales and marketing, customer service. She's been in diverse industries, been in little businesses and in huge companies. She specializes in advising on nanotechnology investment opportunities. And she's obviously a prolific writer on nanotechnology, investing, business, management, social issues. She's had articles in Nanotechnology Now and Nanotechnology Law and Business Journal. I was just checking the Nanotechnology Now site, and it's like a page long of just the list of the articles she's done. She's actively sought out to speak about and be interviewed on pretty much anything about nanotechnology-related topics.
Yeah.
And she is now the president of the Foresight Nanotech Institute. And so, you know, we feel very honored to have you, Dr. Chin, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Steve.
Oh, great. Well, I guess, you know, in visiting with you, kind of getting ready for the show, I said pretty much what we want to talk about is the things that are exciting you in nanotech. What's happening now that, you know, really is exciting?
Well, I think for me what's always exciting is, I think for many people as well, is sort of all the advances they're making in sort of, you know, cancer treatments and cancer detection. I mean, I don't think there are any of us who don't know someone that's been afflicted in some way or somehow with some sort of cancer. So it's always been wonderful for me to hear about any new advances in that particular area, especially with the nanotech and bio-nanotech.
Right, right. Well, I mean, we had, and just a good example is our friend who died just this week, our commenter. I mean, it's just, like you say, you just can't, you can't get to, you know, whatever age you've gotten to and not know, at least a dozen people that have battled cancer or have lost the battle to cancer.
Absolutely.
Just, yeah. So nanotech is you know, the things that are coming forward at this point are detection or treatment or both?
Both, absolutely both. I mean, obviously, one of the most difficult things is detection. I mean, once you find it first. And, of course, most of us, don't find it until it's far too late. You know, many of us ignore the signs until it's far too late. So it's really helpful to have detection technologies that can, you know, you can really have sort of an early intervention that is as well painless as well, to be able to sort of find out what's really going on. And there are so many different cancers, you know, you can't even begin to figure out what exactly you're looking for half the time. So these are great strides that are being made in this particular area.
When do you see these strides manifesting in usable technology that doctors will be using in, you know, doctors' offices?
I think we will see detection probably within the next 5 years or so. There's a lot of strides being made in that area. And detection is one of the easier things to implement in the sense that, you know, the FDA approvals and things like that, it's not as difficult nor as complicated to get through. So I think you'll see that happening far sooner than you'll see in terms of therapies and things like that. Although I think there are a fair amount of things happening at the moment as well, but it's not going to be able to go to human trials for some time.
So do you mean things like drug delivery systems?
Yeah, I mean, there's some wonderful things being done there. But because we're very careful with our FDA and everything, you know, it's going to take a little longer for those particular therapies to get into the regular medical treatments.
Well, you know, some countries don't have the FDA governing. I mean, is it possible that some of these treatments will be seen in other countries before we see it here in the United States?
Well, it's quite possible, quite possible. I mean, as it is, there are people who are going to other countries for therapies already, so I don't really see this particular practice falling off anytime soon.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it pays to be safe, but if you're dying of cancer, then, you know, at some point you just go, well, you know, perhaps I should try this if it seems to be working somewhere else. I can understand, you know, both sides of the argument, you know. And so is cancer detection, and how would that work exactly? What kind of cancer detection, you know, what is nanotech? How would you use nanotech to detect cancer?
Well, I think what they've been doing is they're becoming much better, and actually a lot of this is very biotech as well. There's a lot of overlap, the bio nanotechnology and biotech in general.
Right.
What you're doing is you're looking for proteins or markers, you know, that people will exhibit because there's some reaction to some sort of particular type of cancer cell, whether it be prostate or ovarian or breast cancer. And each type of those cancers will sort of, you know, make the body throw off these particular types of reagents. and the idea is to pick them up. Now, usually what happens at very early stages, you're not really seeing a lot of this in your blood. So, you know, the sensitivity of most of the instrumentation that we've had so far is not able to pick it up, even though it's present in your body in minute amounts. And what nanotechnology is able to do is be able to create sensors as well that are much more sensitive to picking up these just sort of minute quantities of these particular sort of target markers. And that's what's really sort of exciting. The sensitivity levels of detection are much greater than they used to be.
And obviously computers are part of the picture too. I suppose you use nanotech to get, you know, to find out what's, you know, what proteins you're dealing with. But I guess you'd have to go through the data, which might be a mountain of data that they would use some sort of statistical methods with a computer, I suppose, to come up with a diagnosis, I guess. Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, those go hand in hand with most detection systems. I wouldn't say that they're most important. Obviously, I think the most important part is picking the right marker, or the right protein that you're looking for. And once you do that, you get a little bit of a spike, right? So, and then the computer stuff is what you're sort of ironing out the signal-to-noise ratios and amplifying that signal to make sure that you're seeing, or the gain, and to make sure you're seeing what you're supposed to be seeing versus, you know, standard noise.
And obviously, if you're finding this stuff, like I think you'd kind of said this before, if you're finding it earlier, your chances of winning the battle against cancer, I mean, obviously would improve.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, most of the cancers that are the most deadly are the ones where the symptoms don't show up until it's far too late. I mean, by the time you start seeing symptoms and things like ovarian cancer, you're pretty much like in very, very late stages already. So to be able to pick these up at a very, very early stage and, you know, maybe even routine screening, actually, would be a huge jump on the survival rates and treatments as well, but survival rates on top of that.
I think the routine. I'm sorry, PJ. Go ahead.
That's the part I find so fascinating, is the idea of these routine screenings, that you no longer have to wait until you have advanced stage. That this could just be part of your yearly physical, and you can see when the markers turn up. That would be an amazing stride.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry. I was just saying, like you say, human nature is such that if we wait until we have the symptoms, we're going to think, it can't be me. This is not it. And you put it off, and then maybe it's too late. If it's part of a routine screening, every time you go to the doctor, your analysis, they take a little blood or something, then, hey, you don't have to wait until you finally convinced yourself that maybe I need to go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's,
now,
yeah.
I've got a question. I noticed that there's now something called the American Academy of Nanomedicine, and are you a part of this?
Yes, I think I've been invited to be a board member.
To add to the many board seats you already have throughout the nanotech industries?
Well, I think it's an exciting position to be in, and I really admire the work they're doing. So,
very interesting. So where do you see the next steps? We all talk about how in nanotech in general it's being used already. It's simply, working with the very small, and everybody jokes about the stain-free pants and the sunblocks. But where do you see, outside of medicine, sort of the next wave of material coming to?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I tend to think that I have a personal penchant with the cancer therapies. I do tend to see there may be some applications for clean energy and water. And obviously that's very much a foresight, a challenge that we pursue. I think there may be strides there. I think before that, I mean, short of the stain-resistant pants, which I think is actually fabulous, I would think.
Yeah.
I know people make fun of it so much, but I think it's a great idea, and it sure is going to, save me a lot of money on laundry bills, and I don't, it's funny. It's not sexy, but absolutely is fantastic.
Stained pants are not nice either. So yeah, I mean, it's an important breakthrough, but yeah, we're all looking for the nanofactories, I guess, and that's obviously science fiction for a little while yet, I guess.
Well, I mean, I think the most impact and improvements and money that will be made is in those sort of, the sort of what seems mundane. Like I said, it's not sexy, but it's functional, what else? Silver, what do you call it? The the washing machines, I forget exactly if it's Samsung or another company that's doing it, you know, that's in, you know, introducing silver particles into your laundry and your wash to sort of, you know, reduce bacteria or, you know, get rid of bacteria in your clothes, which is what causes most of the smells, you know, when you're in terms of your dirty laundry. I mean, all that kind of stuff is absolutely fantastic. You know, most people have known about the benefits of silver, but even sort of nanoparticle type of silver, it's fascinating.
Well, you know, environmentalists go nuts when they hear things like that. Is there any kind of issue of a danger with these nanoparticles that it could hurt people, you know, I mean, whether it's in your laundry or anywhere else?
Well, I think there's always some danger if you're exposed to too much of it. You know, too much of a good thing is always, you know, bad. Everything in moderation, obviously. It gets to be difficult to control, you know, things like that at some level if it's constantly injecting things into your wash or into your system. So you do have to be careful, I believe. But I don't think you need to go crazy about it. It's interesting because, you know, in particular silver is kind of interesting because it also has sort of antimicrobial and, disease-fighting type of properties as well. A lot of people who are ill take microparticle or nanoparticle silver, colloidal silver, some people say, and some people use it for wounds and things like that because it kills germs. So I don't know. It really depends which particles you're talking about. I think
how about carbon nanotubes or various carbon, you know, things that as they're used more, they'll be more in the environment.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, you know, carbon nanotubes, I think there are the same issues there as in terms of when we have those issues about asbestos or even, you know, carbon fibers and things like that. You know,
obviously carbon's already, I mean, everywhere in nature. I mean, you can't avoid carbon, so it would, like, artificially manufactured carbon things, would that be any different? I mean, or is it the same?
Here's the thing. Carbon nanotubes are not typically used in huge quantities either, partially also because they're very expensive. But typically, just like carbon fibers and things like that, carbon nanotubes are usually fixed in some other type of medium, sort of like in a polymer or matrix medium or something like that. So typically, will be sort of fixed in something. So it's not free floating or in the air. In terms of, you know, will things degrade and it'll become in the air? Well, you know, sure, at some point it will degrade and become in the air. But so do tons of other naturally occurring nanoparticle things, you know, like soot and everything like that. And actually, obviously, everybody knows too much soot, you know, you get black lung disease. But, you know, I don't think that people will be using nanotubes in such large quantities will become such a major problem. I also think that if there are, typical MSDS or OSHA type of safety standards, just like there are with any new materials, I don't think we have that to worry about, really. We really just have to be a little more vigilant about making sure that there are sort of MSDS, which are material safety data sheets, in terms of making sure people are educated on how to handle new materials in general. I think that would be true of any new material, not just carbon nanotubes. And actually, carbon nanotubes are fantastic in terms of some new cancer treatments that they're developing now as well. They're a fantastic delivery or vehicle for drugs. And also, they tend to have this affinity for tumors if you really kind of functionalize them properly. So they'll just go straight to the cancer cell.
Go fishing for cancer. That's an awesome idea, isn't it?
I'd be interested to know exactly what you do with the Foresight Institute. I think the listeners might be interested to understand what Foresight does and what your role in it is.
Oh, well, this is interesting. I guess Foresight Institute has sort of morphed over the years, but I'm the president of the Institute. I think what we are, we're sort of the oldest domestic nanotechnology think tank. We do some public policy work. We do a lot of education work in terms of trying to disseminate information because I think that's really what will make nanotechnology really impactful for society. People need to understand what it is and what it's all about so they're not afraid of it. That's partially, you know, why I'm here on the show as well. But that there are great benefits to nanotechnology, but obviously, you know, everything in moderation, you know, if we regulate things properly, I don't think we'll have any issues. It's about, in terms of Foresight, we also sort of look into the future as well. We want to make sure that, you know, people's views are heard because, you know, technology serves the people. at some point. So it's important to know what they're thinking and what they're afraid of, what they're not afraid of, and what they would like to see. And I think we provide the forum for that. On top of that, we have conferences and things like that where we can do that as well. So,
what do you think nanotechnology's image is right now to the public?
Oh, I think it's much better now. I mean, nanotechnology, as most people have seen, has ups and downs depending on, you know, what the media needs to, if they don't have anything to write about that day.
How true.
Now, and I sometimes just think it just happens. Sometimes it's just kind of luck that it's doing well, and other times it's just, you know, there's other things that people want to talk about, and they don't want to talk about nanotechnology. It can be very faddish sometimes, but in terms of the research and everything, I don't think the research or any of the advances have really waned, depending on public opinion or anything. And it's unfortunate that the public opinion, you know, can be easily manipulated by the media, depending on, you know, what they need to write about that day. But I think it's on the upswing right now in terms of public opinion, and I think that's a good thing. I see a lot of money flowing into it now, and that could change in a few years, depending on, you know, what people are thinking in terms of the investors and what they feel like that day. You know, people's minds change. You know, sometimes people change their mind. They don't like chocolate anymore. They like strawberry, and these things happen. It's kind of odd.
Well, and it's also interesting because the media is much better at feeding a fear of the unknown when it has nothing to base anything on.
Exactly.
So you can talk about, well, some people think this or some people think that. What does Foresight do to educate? Would it be the media? Do you educate business? Who is it that you educate?
We educate more the public, and we talk to the media, obviously. We tend to work a lot with industry as well. So, you know, we sort of talk to everybody, but I think our main focus is the public. We are supported mainly by public, memberships and things like that. We do have relationships with industry, you know, a lot of our conferences. We have some relationships with some government researchers as well, so there's a lot of technical people we deal with as well to make sure we get all the information accurate. But we do really, we provide a lot of forums for our members, you know, to talk about nanotech. And not everyone in our membership is technical. So it becomes really important for us to sort of, you know, talk about it in a way that people understand.
Well, is there a danger that at some point nanotech is everything to the point that your mission gets a little bit diluted? I mean, I guess, you know what I'm saying, that nanotech is the science of the very small, and before you know it, everything will be the science of the very small.
Interdisciplinary.
Yeah,
it crosses
so many fields.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what I think people find it hard to sort of wrap their head around. I mean, I am one of those people that will be the first to tell you that. Nanotechnology does comprise of just about everything, just because everything on the nanotech scale is atoms and molecules, and we're all made of atoms and molecules. Everything we know is made of atoms and molecules. But really what nanotech is sort of the ability now for us to be able to see that at that level. I mean, before that, our technology was not that good. In terms of being able to have that resolution to be able to sort of see things on that small. I mean, actually to see an atom, to actually see a molecule. It used to be that, technical people or researchers sort of imply the presence of these things, you know, based on other tests that they would do. But now they can actually see them, which sort of opens a whole new world for us. I mean, to actually see things, now you can move them around and manipulate them and actually see what happens when you apply a stimulus and see what happens. It really is an approach. It's opening in a whole new way to solve problems. It's not just small. It's because you can be small and see it. You can develop solutions in a much more tailored and very targeted, specific way, which makes it so much more powerful. And it just happens to sort of cross many, many disciplines. In terms of the bio world, physics world, semiconductors and everything. And I think for many people, it's hard to grasp. Because not many people are interdisciplinary, but I think, to sort of understand the world in general, you do have to understand things from a mathematical and a chemical and a physics perspective as well. So I think it forces people to broaden how they look at things in the world that they know. And for me, I think that's quite exciting.
So you're saying basically you see nanotechnology as leading the way in an interdisciplinary science?
Absolutely. I think it's a convergence of all the sciences that we know.
Well, that's pretty big. It doesn't get any bigger than that, does it?
It's really exciting, and can you imagine what the college curriculum is going to be?
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of the nanotechnology college curriculums, but
what would they be? I can't even imagine.
Oh God, you could be like me and be in school forever.
Right.
I guess that's kind of the thing. I mean, you'd have to be knowledgeable in so many different areas. To contribute. Am I wrong? Would you have to be just educated across the board, or does it?
No, not necessarily. I think what you need to do is you need to have an appreciation of the different perspectives in terms of the disciplines, and that they may be adding a different perspective and a dimension to a particular problem, how to solve a problem, that is. I would say, you know, really great work is done in teams, and I think I sort of came from that sort of a graduate research background as well. I was very lucky to have an advisor when I was a graduate student that put together a team of people who were from various different engineering disciplines to solve a similar problem. And it was great, you know, the way we would have our progress meetings, because we would hear, you know, from different perspectives how to look at this problem. And I think that's what's really great. It brings people together, and it brings people to hear about different ways of solving or looking at a problem. And I think that's what's really great about it. And because you do that, you end up learning from each other. So it's not necessarily, you know, it's not that you need to have a really broad training in the university setting. I do think you need to learn that, you know, your perspective as a chemist or your perspective as a biologist is a very limited portion of that whole picture. You just have a little piece of it. And somebody else on the chemistry side, the physics side, has that other piece of it that could actually solve that other section, that question that you had, because your bio training doesn't have the answers. So I think what it does is it pushes people to work together. And if you're really smart, you can sort of straddle two disciplines, you know, so you can have an even better perspective. But, you know, you're still lacking on the other one. So you're going to need other people to work with you to sort of make sure that you understand that the problem is entirely so you can solve it.
I find that really exciting, specifically because I always found that not just in the sciences, but this goes for humanities as well, when people think too specialized a way within their discipline, they so lose the big picture of what they're trying to solve that it almost seems like it's impossible to solve.
Absolutely.
Because you are seeing this now across the board in other disciplines as well, where psychologists are working with neurobiologists, who are working with behavioralists, who are working with, et cetera, to solve much bigger concepts and issues, which is, I think, completely exciting. It's the point of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit like that parable of the elephant, where you have like the five different wise men. They've got each one has a section of the elephant.
Right, right. I don't want the tail. That's the only part I don't want.
Exactly.
Well, and that analogy works so well because the wise men were blind,
exactly.
and at the nano level, we're all blind, or have been until just recently, and now we have all these different disciplines approaching, you know, the very, very small and in slightly different ways and learning from each other. It's an exciting time, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad to be part of it. So.
Yeah.
What got you interested in this? How did you get into it? Because we really didn't explain your background in much depth.
Well, let's see. I think I sort of got into it by accident. And I have a PhD in material science, and my background is chemical engineering. So I was already sort of moving toward becoming more of a generalist anyway, as I sort of went through school. And I think my graduate research was sort of on, ultra-thin polymer films for electronics packaging applications. And I did some work into the neutron reactor at NIST. And so I was already sort of working on systems that were, you know, super, super thin. You know, we're talking maybe 50 to a couple hundred angstroms, which is about, you know, maybe anywhere from 10 to maybe 100 nanometers or something. So I was already on that scale already in terms of, you know, nanotechnology. And then I sort of moved into more of more sales, marketing, and also business strategy, which I found absolutely fascinating because, you know, even though I was very deep tech, I sort of saw that business side of sort of rounding out the entire big picture. In terms of how technology can be brought to the world, and I just thought that was a fabulous thing. So now I was understanding how companies were working, how people were working together in teams, and how people, you know, developing products and bringing it to market, and how that sort of fit into the whole economy, and how things were priced, and how people valued certain things and didn't value other things. So sort of the market reactions. And then I think I was just sort of coming out of one consulting gig, and I'd heard about nanotech because at that point I was just so busy. I wasn't even listening to half the stuff that was going on. And I started reading up on what was happening, and I realized, oh, well, this is what I do. I already do this. So this is how I sort of got into it. Once I figured out what they were all talking about, what all the buzz was about, I realized I was already doing it. And for me, that was great because then I realized I have a much better grasp on this than most people do. Only because I had such a generalist mentality already that I was already seeing that interdisciplinary participation and cooperation, and you know, it just sort of opened whole new doors for me. So that's how I sort of got into it.
Well, thinking about it on a sort of macro business level or a global business level, how do you see the international either nations or large corporations? How do they stack up in terms of their development of nanotechnology? Are there certain nations that are developing it more quickly? Are there certain major companies that are developing more quickly?
I think, you know, obviously the United States has always been on the forefront, but I do believe that we're sort of falling behind. We've gotten a little bit complacent in believing that we are number one in terms of technology. And you know, for a long time we were. We pumped a huge amount of money into research, and a lot of it is basic research, but we're not doing that as much anymore. You know, we're having economic problems, and I think most of the big companies are pulling back on their research monies, and I think that's a big mistake, actually, and you know, because they're trying to meet short-term I'm glitching all of a sudden.
People were, you know, looking at the short-term bottom line rather than looking at the long term. Is that right?
Right. Exactly. Look, in the short term, they're trying to meet analyst goals, you know, on the markets. You know, everybody's on TV and everybody's watching the economy and how the stock market's doing. So everybody's so concerned about meeting those sort of short-term, you know, quarter goals in terms of their share prices and everything that people just sort of lost sight of, you know, how that basic research is that, you know, it forms that foundation. And because of that, the other countries like Singapore and even, you know, Great Britain, you know, they're just sort of like, you know, in Japan, obviously, oh, my gosh, you know, and China, they're just sort of, you know, trying to fill that gap. And I think it's something to worry about. But, you know, everything in the spirit of competition in that sense, I mean, you know, may the best man win. And if you actually can do better, you should absolutely do better.
Well, that's why I think it's a little bit self-correcting, isn't it? If you ignore R&D long enough, everybody's left you behind. And so, you know, you get slapped down pretty quick, I suppose, when your competition comes out with some blockbuster drug or whatever.
And, of course, so there are two kinds of R&D. You've got your short-term R&D, where you have expectations, I guess it would be 2 to 5 years out, is that correct, usually? But then you've got long-term R&D. Like, I'm fascinated by this guy, Fred Kavli, who's been putting his own personal foundation money into the work of scientists, and he's very into nanotechnology, but specifically into scientists who will not be getting the government or corporate grants because it isn't for short-term realization.
Yeah, much more blue sky stuff. Yep.
Yes, exactly, blue sky. I'm fascinated that there is a guy out there who is putting his money into blue sky research.
It's interesting how the market works like that. It is very self-correcting, like you said, Stephen. You know, whereas, you know, sometimes you can't get money from government, but there's, you know, somebody out there who's willing to be an angel investor and to invest in something that no one else will, and they happen to be one with a heck of a lot of money. So,
yeah.
You know, you hope that, you know, everyone, all the millionaires out there, all the people who've made all that money, you know, you're hoping that they're going to give back and put it back in the community in some way, shape, or form, and this is exactly what they should be doing, and it's wonderful to see that actually happening. So, you know, someone's going to drive it. If it's not the government, you know, someone will, and it's good.
Are there a lot more people like Fred Kavli out there, or is he's the only one I know of off the top of my head?
I think there are. I think there are people out there who are putting monies into research where they have a personal interest in. You know, some of it is nanotech, some of it's not. You know, a lot of, you know, I mean, we see a lot of money going into cancer research in general just because, you know, people have sort of a personal tie to it. And I think there are people like that out there.
when I think of blue sky research, I think of DARPA, you know, which is obviously government. It's defense related, but there's often so much that those guys have come up with in the past that spills over into the private sector too.
And they definitely have a mandate that's, well, at least it used to. I'm wondering if this has changed in recent years, but they certainly used to say, you know, if you think it's impossible and it can't happen for 20 to 30 years, we're the people to do it.
Yeah, we're working on it.
We're working on it, right.
I love those guys.
I love them, me too. But I do hear that that's starting to tighten up.
I think you're right. I think that is changing. I think DARPA is not as much focused on blue skies as it used to be, which is a shame, actually.
Well, you know, I've heard recently they're spending a lot of time and effort on things like artificial limbs and things like that, and they're doing it for the short term so that they can, you know, people that have lost limbs in Iraq or Afghanistan have, you know, obviously that's good work too, and it's very, very important and needs to be done. But it seems like maybe we should be expanding the budget of you know, DARPA so that they can do that and, as well as the blue sky research that could help deliver the future.
If only there was that much money to go around.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, most of the money is going into the war, as most people know, so.
Yeah. Well, I basically skimmed an article you had done, Dr. Chen, about investing in nanotech and how, you know, some of these funds that, like, are labeled nanotech funds, how do you feel about those funds? Let me ask you.
How do I feel about those funds?
Yeah, you would.
Let's see. Well, I tend to think, you know, there's a bit of a lemming mentality in much of the investor circles. And there are a lot of people out there who are trying to sort of capitalize on the buzz more than the actual research.
Yeah.
I've got an MBA as well, and I have friends who are in investment banking and who are investors in general. And I see things that happen that shouldn't be happening. I see companies that, you know, some of these investors or these investment bankers want to make go public, which probably shouldn't go public. But, you know, they're for them it's all about making sure the company looks great to the market so that they can make a heck of a lot of money out of it versus, you know, it being a very viable company with, you know, that has sustainability and actually has a viable product that, you know, that people are willing to pay for. So there's a lot of manipulation in the market in terms of, you know, companies that are nanotech hoping to make a fast buck.
Right.
And I don't think it's just nanotech.
Well, it's happening with biotech as well. There's still money floating into that as well. But, you know, so I see a lot of that going on. I see a lot of people just sort of putting money in because, you know, someone sounds good. But, you know, I think most of the investors are not as tech savvy. And, you know, even today we're talking about what exactly is nanotech. Most people don't even know what it is. So it makes me very worried. You know, that there's tons of money being pumped into, you know, maybe so-called investment opportunities that are not really viable or not ready to be invested in at that level and maybe even should still be in the early stages or in terms of angel investors, you know, maybe not so early that it's blue sky, but, you know, it still needs to be sort of pushed along. It's not quite there yet. So, I have some issues, you know. I think they're just trying to make a lot of money, and I don't think they really, you know, I mean, for themselves in the short term, I don't think they're really interested in making sure that the technology is actually going to work.
Well, you know, when the Internet got going, I mean, obviously people saw the potential. And then, of course, we had the dot-com bust, you know. Are you fearful that, you know, that you have enough people out there, you know, hyping this claim or that claim, and then we get a bubble, and then nanotech, anything that's called nanotech from here forward has a bad name? I mean, is that a fear, or...?
Yeah, I always worry that, you know, people are going to sort of shy away from it after a couple of bad experiences, you know, and then, you know, and where they really blow up, they really blow up, so you'll hear about them.
Right.
But, you know, I think the savvier investors, the smart ones, you know, we'll have people who are sort of technology, you know, with a technology background but understand the business and understand the development cycles, who really can do their due diligence. A lot of people just aren't doing their due diligence, and I think that's kind of scary. But I am worried that some of the really good stuff is to be looked over, you know, just because they're going to be lumped into the whole pile of nanotech and go, oh, well, it's all bad. And that's not necessarily true. You know, you've got to really dig you know, for the really good ones. But most people aren't willing to look for that. They're just, you know, most people are just willing to make the fast stuff. So I am concerned that the stuff that really should be funded isn't going to be funded, and it's going to be delayed, which will be, you know, sad because, you know, it's a really great technology that can really benefit a lot of people. So, yeah, I am concerned about that. So.
And it is a delay, though. It isn't something where that technology actually disappears. Because certainly, you know, you look at the cycle, the traditional cycle of hype, bubble, bust. Eventually, the good companies will out. If somebody's got a product that serves a purpose, don't you think it does eventually come to the marketplace?
I think eventually comes to the marketplace. It won't. It may not come, you know, the way that originally intended. What you hate to see companies go bust because they couldn't sustain themselves, even though they had great technology, although bad management.
Right.
And what you'll see is, you know, and like many distressed companies with distressed funds in that sense, you know, someone will come in and buy the technology, buy the patent. So it will end up somewhere. You know, it just will be delayed, and maybe in a way that people didn't really intend it to begin with. But it won't disappear.
Dr. Chen, I want to go ahead and open up the lines. Just in case anybody would like to call in and ask a question of Dr. Pearl Chen. This is Fast Forward Radio, and our call-in number is 347-215-8972 if you have any questions for her. I guess the question I'm dying to ask, but it's kind of almost fearful to, is there any way as an investor to get into investing in nanotech, or are pretty much any technology companies that you do your due diligence on, just look at technology companies across the board, do your due diligence, and then invest appropriately, or how should one go about it?
Well, I would say, I mean, if you're sort of a risk averse investor, I would invest in, you know, well known companies that have always done really good basic research. You know, the large companies like IBM, DuPont, HP, you know, and that's a very safe bet, you know, typically, because they're large enough, and if they have issues, they have other products that will sort of, you know.
If one goes bust, I've got other things going, yeah.
Right. However, you know, if you're really interested in doing, you know, some really cool nanotech stuff, you've got to really take the time, and because most of the stuff is private, that's really cool. The stuff that's kind of public, you know, I'm a little wary of, because a lot of the stuff is sort of out there before its time. And a lot of it is more intellectual property than product, and that's a personal pet peeve of mine. I'm not into pushing intellectual property as much as I am in terms of product. So you've really got to sort of do your homework or your due diligence and try to find out who's out there, what kind of companies are out there, what kind of products are they pushing, and you know, what's the plan, you know, who's their competition. I mean, you know, just as you would for any investment, even if it's public, not public. So you know, it's not easy. If you want to go into this, you know, I would visit, you know, some. Oh, I don't know. This is a tough one.
Yeah. It's just as always in any kind of investing, you just have to be careful, I guess.
You have to be very, very careful. I mean, there are a lot of scams out there too. You know, people are saying there's a nanotech company, or they invest in nanotech, and they want you to invest in them because they're investing in nanotech. So you got to be really careful. And I think, you know, I'm lucky in the sense that I get a lot of stuff, a lot of business plans come across my desk, and to me it's fascinating. But, you know, I'll know a scam when I see one.
And it helps that you've got the background that you have to know, you know, this isn't realistic. This is, you know, you have a built-in alarm, you know. A BS detector, as I like to say. But a lot of people don't have that because, again, they just don't know. You know, often we're surprised by reality, and then shocked that there are some things that are not possible that we think ought to be possible. So, you know, I guess it just depends on how much you're paying attention.
Also, the flip side is people taking things on face value. My favorite is when people were putting nano in the front of every company name. There was that, you know, 2 or 3 year period where everyone was launching companies nano this, nano that, and had nothing to do with nanotechnology.
Yep. Yeah, oh, that was bad. That was horrible. I was watching this and I was going, oh, I cannot believe people are falling for this.
Yeah, and I mean, if they were mixing ammonia and whatever, you know, any two chemicals, they could call themselves nano companies. You know, and it'd have nothing to do with nano. It's just basic chemistry or something, you know, whatever.
I think generally, I mean, a rule of thumb is if something sounds really, really too good to be true, it probably is not.
Yeah. That's just good old-fashioned wisdom. That
common sense.
It works even in the nano era.
This stuff takes a while. You know, so if someone tells you they're going to market in the next 2 years, I'd be very wary. You know, just having been somebody, you know, who used to work in a lab and know other scientists and things like that, and know how they sort of work and think, you know, this stuff takes a long time to develop. And if someone tells you it's going to, like, happen, like, tomorrow, or, you know, and they're going to make, you know, they're going to go IPO in 2 years, I'd be really concerned. You know, I'd be like,
yeah.
Oh, really? You know?
Well, you've been on top of this for a number of years, and so you know the stuff that is going to come out tomorrow. I mean, the stuff that you know, you've seen the background. You've seen it move through the pipeline. What cool stuff can we expect to see in 2008?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of the really cool stuff has already just come out, and it's still happening, I think. I think there's going to be a gap for maybe a year or two before you really see anything else. I've been really enjoying, you know, stain-resistant pants.
Yeah. What about batteries?
You're convincing me to go buy some.
Yeah. What about really? Batteries?
Batteries are not going to be near term. I think they're having some issues in terms of manufacturing. A lot of the problems is I think people don't realize there's some really fantastic technology out there. I mean, stuff that comes out of lab. You know, our scientists are really, you know, our students and scientists are really great. But you know, from an engineering perspective, you know, they don't create technologies, you know, based on how easy is it going to make or how inexpensive is it going to make. And really, what's going to take is something that's going to be not expensive to manufacture on a large scale. So a lot of stuff, you know, that is fantastic technology is too expensive to make, unless, of course, you know, you're planning on selling it to the military because they're probably the only ones who can afford it. So I think people don't realize that, and I've seen some really great technology, but a lot of it's just too expensive to make or you know, the chemicals they use are too toxic, so there are environmental issues. You know, now you have to factor in the cost of cleaning up, basically, toxic waste and things like that. And, you know, and people don't even think about that side of it. So people don't sort of see that whole big picture. So a lot of it has to be cost-effective manufacturing. The stuff I like is the stuff that's already come out, which is like, you know, like nanoparticles that can, reduce emissions.
Yeah. And
that's handy.
It's very, very important. That, I mean, you know, like you say, it doesn't have to be sexy to change things. That can be, you know, all we have to do is clean up our cars just a little bit, and you multiply that by the number of cars on the road.
Yeah, they have coatings that they're painting tunnels now, you know, that can reduce the emissions, you know, of the cars going through. You know, it breaks down all the emissions into a non-toxic gases. That's fantastic. I mean, you know, in terms of a global warming a health perspective, I'm sure there was something else I was thinking about. Self-cleaning windows. I mean, you know, I think people thought maybe 3 years ago that wasn't going to happen. And then, you know, I think wasn't more than just a year ago that, you know, Pilkington, you know, creates their self-cleaning windows and they get bought out by Nippon Glass. I mean, that is, you know, like a classic example of how nanotechnology should be commercialized and come into the market. I mean, that's like a great story.
Well, how does that work? I'm sorry, PJ.
I'm just saying, I'm waiting for my solar cells, my more efficient solar cells.
Oh, yeah. That's a game changer there. I mean,
that's a big game changer, and I'll be the first to sign up.
Yeah. Well, if you know, you just have to improve solar just a little bit, and then it becomes competitive with the grid, and then that changes everything, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, for solar, it's the efficiency, and then it's also the manufacturing as well. Solar cells, you know, you use some highly caustic acids and things like that for manufacturing, for etching, you know, because we're talking about silicon and things like that. So, you know, if they can figure out a way to do it, you know, without all that environmental issues and the danger, I think we can have a much better or much more less expensive solar cell that, you know, and practically every home can have it.
That's great. That's great.
I think, Stephen, did you ask me about how self-cleaning windows work?
Yeah. How does that work exactly? I mean, what process how is nano involved in helping windows clean themselves? How does that work?
I think this is nanoparticles again, and I hope people aren't too sick about hearing about nanoparticles. Nanoparticles. I think your typical metal when it becomes small when they're at that level of size, the surface area to volume ratio is huge. much greater. I mean, I'm trying to use layman terms. What's interesting is, for some reason, when it gets to that level, that size, the surface gets highly reactive. So now it becomes a catalyst, just like your platinum, catalyst and your catalytic converters, that type of thing. So it becomes really reactive. And what happens is when, bacteria or, dirt, which is organic material, falls on these particular particles, it just it oxidizes and zap. It's like broken up.
Wow.
Does that coating last forever, or is it something that has to periodically be replaced? Or
I'm not sure. I'll have to ask the window.
Yeah. I need to look it up myself. Well, I appreciate it.
I know the steam resistant pants, they start to lose their ability to resist stains or water. So I think that's an issue. But after several washings, I think it kind of loses the effect. So
that's good for a while though, and that's helpful, isn't it?
It's great.
I guess planned obsolescence. So.
That's right.
Great party trick,
That's right. Dr. Chen, I think we're running out of time here. As far as the far future goes, I mean, I understand. You have to kind of talk about what really is, your hopes and goals all the time, but what are, for the long term, what are the hopes and goals of what nanotechnology can accomplish?
Oh, let me see. I mean, I think the goals are the same, as when the Foresight Nanotech Institute first started. The idea is to some point, have nanotechnology cost effective, so that, at some point it could eradicate poverty, it could provide clean water, health benefits, to everyone, regardless of their income, that's sort of the very, very sort of, open foresight mission in that sense. I think the idea is to be able to, create food and things like that, and in this sense, we're sort of moving back toward that whole molecular manufacturing idea. I think when Eric Drexler's book Engines of Creation sort of came out, so I think in the long term that's still very, very possible. It just depends what time span you're talking to.
Right. Well, that's exactly. If somebody starts talking about delivering a nano factory in the next couple of years, your alarm bells go off then.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
So we just once again, you have to kind of be careful. You do your homework and before you put your dollars out there, I guess.
Exactly.
Okay. Dr. Chen, thank you so much. PJ, I'm sorry, I was kind of wrapping it up without going back to you. Is anything else you need to ask?
No, I'm great. It was wonderful talking to Dr. Chen.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chen.
Thank you both, you PJ, and thank you, Stephen, for having me on.
It was fun.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun, too.
Okay. Good night.
Bye.
All right. Well, PJ, it was very, very interesting to get to talk to Pearl about all these things. I mean, it's difficult to make a segue from something like that that could actually change the world to smaller things. But, obviously she's right on top of it.
Absolutely. I mean, nanotechnology has such potential to change everything, and it probably will. That she really is on the forefront of some amazingly exciting stuff.
Oh yeah, she's on the edge, the cutting edge. Yeah, I have actually seen. I'm just gonna make an abrupt segue here. Okay, I saw a movie last week, The Golden Compass, and I know TJ, you haven't seen it.
I'm holding out for the holidays to take my kids.
Well, you're gonna enjoy it. It's a good movie. And you've seen a movie I haven't seen that I want you to talk about in a minute.
You got it.
I Am Legend, right? You saw that?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try not to give away too much to ruin your experience with The Golden Compass. But I want to share enough to kind of whet your appetite. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful film. Looks great. Great cast. It's fun. I mean, if you've seen the previews, you know that it's something weird's going on in this film. It's about a parallel universe. Everyone's soul is visible. They have companion animals that walk around with them that everybody else can see, and that's like, your soul or whatever. And that you know, that weirdness is handled so beautifully, it becomes where it's not even distracting after a while. And then the technology that's surrounding all that is a kind of a steampunk theme.
I love steampunk.
Oh,
I'm forward to that.
It can be gorgeous if it's handled correctly, and it is here. And they got some kind of weird energy source that's powering all this. It looks like, I don't know, balls of plasma or something, but it's beautiful. They got the zeppelins and the, you know, it looks like a horseless carriage rather than a car kind of thing that
Right. Everybody's
driving around in. It's a cool film. It feels like that there's some gaps in the narrative, and of course you have to do that when you're adapting a book.
Oh yes.
You know, when you're adapting a book, you can't include it all, or it'll be a 6-hour movie.
Exactly right.
Or more. And so, you know, I felt the gaps in a couple of places, and you can do it smooth, but unless you're doing it to perfection and maybe even inventing some things to cover, you know, the plot holes that you leave by leaving out certain segments, you can't do it to the satisfaction of all the fans of the book, and people that are new to it. There's always going to be stuff like that, I guess, when you're adapting something like this.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I don't know if you want me to segue now to the I Am Legend.
Go ahead.
Okay. Very interesting, because there's similar issues with I Am Legend. I Am Legend is based on the Richard Matheson novella I Am Legend, which is a real classic, and this is the fourth time the movie's been made.
Omega Man was one of them, wasn't it?
Omega Man, Last Man on Earth with Vincent Price, which was an Italian cheapie.
Yeah.
And then there's this hilarious company that does takeoffs of either imminent movies that are going to come out, so they want to confuse people and think that you're renting, you know, the other one.
Yeah.
Or just blatant ripoffs where they change the names and it's the same damn movie. They even take the ad campaigns and it's the same thing. And this one's called I Am Omega. So,
oh, man.
Yeah, oh, it's so cheesy.
Yeah.
But I Am Legend is as far from cheesy as you can get. I mean, visually, it's stunning. Now, I'm from New York, and I actually had a really emotional time watching places I knew look like that.
And how did they accomplish that?
With extraordinary CGI. I can't wait for my husband and my copy of Cinefex magazine to arrive, because I know it'll be the cover story. And what's wonderful, this magazine, Cinefex, has been doing it for like 25 years. They go really behind the scenes in a very detailed way for people in the special effects industry, and they really show how stuff is done. And I can't wait to find out how they did some of this stuff, because the amount of plate work, blue screen, it is so beautifully art directed. When you look at the scene in Times Square where he's stalking in the high grass in the center
wow.
of, you know, stalking deer in Times Square, it just, you know, with all the billboards you recognize and the theaters showing the musicals that you know that were there.
That was there when everything
exactly,
was bad.
Exactly,
yeah.
when everything went terribly wrong. In short, it's a really beautiful to look at film. Will Smith is truly one of the great stars of all time. However, the adaptation of the story had some enormous holes in it. A lot of what I call, Hitchcock called refrigerator logic, those moments where you come out of the theater, you go to the fridge, you open it up, you go, wait a second.
What about that?
What about that? That doesn't make any sense.
While you're sitting in the theater, you were okay.
Right, exactly. So, you know, because the trick is to keep the ride going as fast as possible. And for the most part, they accomplished that goal. But there's a lot of moments where even in the movie, my husband and I looked at each other and went, what? you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
But there's some wonderful moments as well. However, I will say I was not a fan of the zombie work. I will say they're in this one, they're basically vampiric zombies. The entire world has been decimated by a virus to kill cancer, to eliminate cancer, that mutates and goes bad. And either you die or you're turned into this morphed zombie slash vampire. You can't come out during the daytime. UV destroys your skin. So they live by night. They hunt by night. They're cannibalistic. They hunt each other. It affects animals, etc. And only Will Smith can go out during the day. And then at night he has to hunker down and pray the zombies don't get him. But the zombies really bum me out.
Because they didn't look right? Or
they just looked cheesy. This is where CGI, to me, still has real problems, and that is that uncanny valley.
Oh, yeah.
Where it doesn't look quite right, and your eye can pick out what things don't make sense and have been sort of glossed over in the design process, but for whatever reason they haven't accomplished it just right, and it's just jarring.
It seems to me that maybe they would have... The best compromise would have been to do the CGI on the backgrounds, but then use makeup on human actors for the zombies, rather than try to do CGI zombies.
Look, I would have much preferred it if they'd actually used real animals in a lot of the cases. The CGI lions didn't do it for me either. And then again, that's another Uncanny Valley where we know what lions look like. We
right.
see lions. And so they don't look quite right, and, I don't know. However, the live dog is one of the biggest stars now in Hollywood. The dog who plays Sam, oh, my God, the dog rips his heart out. Great dog. Great movie dog. One of the best movie dogs I've ever seen.
Well, in you're a big fan. He must have saved Will Smith a couple of times or something.
Saved Will Smith, but she's a wonderfully evocative face. She's a beautifully trained German Shepherd, and
they left the CGI off the dog. I hope they didn't try to make
goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's only one moment, and I'm not going to ruin it for anybody. The dog definitely gets some work, and in fact, it may have actually been a prosthetic dog. I'm not 100% sure. I'd actually have to really look at it and look back at it, but yeah, no, she's a
Hey, let me ask this. Being involved in the film community, does that ruin it, your experience? Are you taking apart movies too much to enjoy them now?
No. I would say for some people it doesn't, for some people it doesn't. For me, I still go along for the ride. In fact, my husband is extremely, he could deconstruct everything when he watches it.
Uh-huh.
But he still can enjoy the ride too, but I totally enjoy the ride and really can only think about stuff in retrospect and go, oh wait.
Yeah.
For me, the ride of I Am Legend has some issues as well, which lots of reviewers have talked about, and I tend to agree.
Yeah.
But there are parts of it where you just go, wow. It's really, sort of jaw-dropping in its...
You know, that project has been around... I'm sorry. That project has been around forever in Hollywood. It was actually, at one point, it was attached to Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, and Tom Cruise and Michael Douglas and Michael Bay was supposed to direct it. It's
yeah.
gone through so many different permutations.
It's one of those things that people began to think, hey, nobody, it's never going to get done.
Exactly. And I'm thrilled that Will Smith is the guy to do it, because he is, if anybody can hold a movie and for large parts of it only act against a dog, there are only a handful of people on the planet who could keep your attention for that long with no dialogue or talking to a dog who's not a lot of bounce back on that. He really holds the screen in a way that a lot of people we call mute movie stars just could not.
Yeah. Well, I've been a big fan of Will Smith forever, and he can get me in a theater seat about as good as anybody, I think.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. I want to get back to my movie just real quick. Golden Compass has got this controversy around it, which have you heard anything about this?
I've heard a lot about it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the Catholic League and various other Christian groups are saying, "Hey, this is anti-religion and all that." I got to tell you, I've read some synopsis. I have not read the books, and I understand at least one family member of yours, PJ, has.
Oh, both my children have. Yes.
Okay. Well, I've read synopsis of the books, and the first book doesn't really get into it all that much. The Magisterium is, apparently maybe it was meant to be a stand-in for the Catholic Church. And then in the second and third books, it's a little bit more anti-religious. And the writer doesn't make any bones about it. He's an atheist, and his views come across in the books. But I got to tell you, I don't see anything that is all that you know, shocking or anything in this movie at all. You know, you just...
Yeah, it's interesting because I have to really read the books, but I've done a lot of reading about them. I've talked to my kids a lot about them. And from what I gather, it's not so much that he's anti-religion. He's anti-authoritarian religion. He's anti a religion that says you can only do this and you cannot do this, and we will tell you how you will live, and that is the way things are, and it's our way, the highway. That's what he's against. And the
hey, Jamie, let me. I want to bring in our caller here. Phil, is that you?
Hi, it is me.
Hi, Phil.
Yay. Hey, Stephen. Hey, PJ.
Hey.
Hey, I'm glad you made it, man.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. You guys are doing great. I don't mean to break the flow here.
We were just talking about the Golden Compass. Have you seen that yet?
Not yet. I haven't had a chance to yet. Looking forward to seeing it hopefully sometime this week.
Well, and
my daughter's out watching it right now, actually.
Really? Well, she's in for a good time. It's a beautiful movie as far as how it looks. The pacing, there's a couple of spots, and it ends on a kind of a weird note. But I mean, it's set up for a sequel, and ultimately we will judge it as a trilogy probably rather than as a single movie. But I enjoyed it very much and would recommend anybody go see it. But Pete Day is exactly right. I think it's really anti-authoritarian religion instead of just anti-religious. And really, I mean, that's not all that shocking. I mean, that's, you know, pretty much society's already bought that message as it is.
I don't think this is really ruining the punchline for anything, but I think they go after the person, the being that claims to be God, and what you find out is he isn't God.
Right.
So when everybody talks about faith, they kill God. No, well, actually, they don't. they kill somebody who claimed he was, but wasn't.
Yeah.
So there's a big difference, and I think, you know, it's kind of ironic. I have not read it nor seen the movie, and we're all talking about it, but I think the great irony is a lot of people discussing it who actually haven't read it, seen it, they've only been told about it, and it's hard to honestly criticize unless you actually, you know, I think have read it and understood it. So I'm certainly willing to give it the benefit of all kinds of doubts. Regardless.
Well, it just looks cool. I mean, you got a talking armed bear walking around. I mean, who's not going to go see that?
And it's Ian McKellen, and you know, I could listen to him read the phone book.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I put it down to this: if you're a person of faith that sees science and faith as irreconcilable, you're going to have a problem with this movie. Everybody else is going to have a good time. You know, I mean, if you're either not a person of faith or if you're a person of faith who sees science and faith as something that can work together, you're going to be fine. And I'm sorry.
I would say, Stephen, just since we're all talking about it and none of us have read it, I guess I can throw in my two cents. I read a good article in The Atlantic. It's online, and I'll provide a link about the transformation of some of Pullman's ideas from the book, where I think it's a little more evident what he's getting at to the movie, where I think they toned it down just a little bit, and it's not quite as... maybe quite as strident in making some of his points, but it's pretty interesting reading. He's an interesting character, a little hard to take. My only problem with him, I don't have a problem with somebody being an atheist. I don't have a problem with somebody wanting to make, you know, their particular point about the Catholic Church, but he really trashes C.S. Lewis, and I have a hard time with him.
Yeah. We have soft spots in our heart for the guy who came up with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. You know, it's like I'm kind of a live and let live guy, you know. It's like I like the polar bear, but you gotta let Narnia stay too.
Yeah, I mean, and
I like all this.
And come on, I mean, him and his buddy, J.R.R. Tolkien, invented the genre he's playing in, so he ought to give props to the master.
Oh, and he trashes Tolkien too. So,
well, yeah, again, he needs to give credit for the people who built his playground.
Gentlemen, don't forget, he's also trashing them because it makes good copy.
That's right.
We're all talking about it. Yeah,
that's right.
We're doing his job for him right now.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Well, that's great. Well, Phil, we have a guest coming next week, don't we?
Next week we're going to have James Hughes on, one of the founders of the World Transhumanist Association. Is that correct, PJ? I think.
Yeah, one of my fellow board members as well.
Exactly. So looking forward to talking with him. He's I think, got some interesting stuff to say, and he was available the week of Christmas, so should be
PJ
good.
Is a great person to know. You know that?
you know
everybody in the futures community.
He's all connected, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it's amazing. It happened in a very short time, and I'm starting to realize, wow, I really do know a lot of people. But no, James is one of the people who I first got to know when I first started doing my research. He was unbelievably helpful, totally opened up doors for me, gave me recommendations for people to talk to and meet, and really it was through James. He, if anybody's connected, he is ground zero, or certainly one of the ground zeros. He's a great guy, a fun guy, a funny guy, a very gutsy guy, and I think you guys will have a really good time with him.
Well, that's great.
Well, be sure and listen in if you get a chance, PJ.
I will.
Well, that's good. Well, I mean, I guess it's time to wrap this show up. Do either of you have any other thing y'all want to cover before we do?
No. Hey, thanks for letting me on. Thanks for going a few minutes late so I can join.
Oh.
And thanks for having me at all. Wonderful fun. Thanks,
PJ. You're a blast, and thank you so much for co-hosting with me tonight.
I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Our music tonight is from a band, and this is appropriate, Phil, I think, because half of our hosts and our guests, both ladies, it's the band called Girl Stuff. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, and so anyway, I think you guys will enjoy it. It's the song is Blue, and we get this started. And I had a great time tonight. And join us again next Sunday night, same time, same place. And
all right.
And I wanted to announce the time. It's we're now at 10 Eastern, 9 Central, 8 Mountain, 7 Pacific. Good night, y'all.
Good night.
I can't believe what you said.
Thank you.